Hello, Absurdistanis, and welcome to Absurdistan, the transatlantic political podcast with news and opinion from the absurd political reality which is our home. My name is Adam.
And my name is John.
This episode, we take a look at the events on the Gaza-Israeli border as they unfolded this week. We'll fill you in on the outcome of the Iraqi elections and why it's bad news for both the US and Iran. And John tackles the history and context of the DACA program and where it is now. All that, as well as our look ahead, coming up. But first, John, how you doing?
Doing well. You know me, Adam. I don't usually buy into the tabloidy side of politics.
Of course not.
I much prefer stories that focus on policy, and I really don't like stories that attack people personally. But I couldn't help but laugh at this. I got a chuckle out of this story this week. I know it's old. It's actually been out for a couple weeks now. They found Donald Trump's perfect doppelganger. And she is a potato farmer from Spain. I don't know if you've seen this.
I have. This made the rounds, as you said, a few weeks ago, and folks here get a real kick out of it. It's a Galician potato farmer, I think, and the likeness is uncanny.
She looks just like him. And even in the photo that's been circulating, she has that sort of pursed lip smolder face that Trump has. She's even making the same expression. It's just uncanny, the resemblance. If you guys get a chance, if you listeners get a chance, go ahead and Google that for a laugh.
I think she's known as, is it Senora Trump or Senora Presidente? Something like that. She's got her own nickname.
I think it's Senora Trump.
There you go.
Pretty sure. But hilarious. I saw that and I was like, this is just a personal attack. Trump looks like a woman. And then I clicked on it and oh my goodness, it's really, the resemblance is uncanny. They could be twins.
Unfortunately, we do need to change tracks a little bit because going from kind of happy, fun news, there was a series of events that happened in Israel this week on the Gaza border. So John, I know that you wanted to take us through that.
The Gaza-Israeli border is no stranger to violent demonstrations. In recent years, there's been an uptick of protests along the border. We've seen this be a real flashpoint recently, especially with the Trump administration's announcement last year to move the United States embassy to Jerusalem and officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital. The United States was one of the first countries to do this. Some others have followed suit. But this is very controversial because if you know, both the Palestinians and the Israelis claimed Jerusalem as their capital, and historically, the city has been split between Arab Israelis and Israelis living there. On top of that, May 14th marked the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the State of Israel, which obviously is a controversial point in the Middle East. And the day after that, May 15th, is recognized as what's called Nakba Day. This is a remembrance of the exodus of almost 700,000 Palestinians during the 1948 Palestine War after Israel became a state and the surrounding nations invaded almost immediately. So there's a lot of political tension around this event. Not only the fact that the embassy was being moved to Jerusalem, the international community has historically recognized Tel Aviv as the capital of Israel, but also that it's coinciding with these anniversaries and with these holidays that are very important to the Palestinians. So on the day of the opening of the embassy, we saw massive protests break out on this border fence. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, estimated that there were up to 30,000 Palestinians on the fence protesting. Some, they claimed, throwing firebombs and actively trying to attack the fence, although these reports have been disputed. There's some video that's come out from behind Palestinian lines where it appears that most of these people were unarmed, and although they were protesting, they weren't attacking the fence directly. And in response to these protests, the Israelis responded with live fire and in some cases actually used snipers. This ultimately killed at least 58 Palestinians and wounded almost 2,000 others, which is a massive amount of casualties. No Israelis were harmed. So the casualties were very one-sided. The IDF came out and said that they responded in this way because this protest was being used as a cover by Hamas to carry out an attack, and they even claimed that there were Hamas terrorists who were trying to plant bombs on the fence using this protest as cover, and that's what the snipers were responding to. This was bolstered this week. A Hamas official came out and claimed that 50 of the 58 people that were killed were Hamas members, although that can't be independently verified. Not sure why that claim was made. It may have been political posturing, but Israel has latched onto that and said that this confirms their side of the story. Mm. And as you can imagine, the international reactions have been largely negative. One of the most outspoken responses was from President Erdogan of Turkey, ironically enough, responding to what he called essentially war crimes. And there was a bit of a Twitter spat between Netanyahu and Erdogan where they really went at each other. Erdogan had a very negative reaction.
I can only imagine an Israeli-Turkey head of state Twitter battle. That's the modern time that we're living in.
Yeah, and they actually expelled or suggested that the Israeli consulate in Turkey were to go home. Many other countries around the world have actually either summoned the Israeli ambassadors to explain what's going on or even actually suggested that they leave in protest of what's going on. Officials in the South African government actually went so far as to compare the Israeli actions in Palestine to South African apartheid, which is a very strong statement, in fact, essentially implying that the Israelis are carrying out close to an ethnic cleansing or genocide against the Palestinians. And surprisingly, you actually had the United States' ally, Saudi Arabia, highly criticizing the move to Jerusalem of the embassy and also criticizing the actions of Israel against Palestine. So you're seeing even allies of the United States coming out against this. At the UN, the United States backed the Israeli actions at the UN. And Nikki Haley went so far as to suggest that other nations may not have even shown as much restraint as Israel did. She actually said, quote, "Who among us would accept this type of activity on our border? No one would. No country in this chamber would act with more restraint than Israel has. In fact, the records of several countries here today suggest they would be much less restrained," which I suppose is not unexpected. The United States is Israel's top ally, and we have defended much worse than they've done in the past. So before I give my opinion on this, Adam, what are your thoughts?
So I'm certainly no Netanyahu apologist. I find it very difficult to actually back the policy platform regarding Palestine. But I don't see Israel necessarily as this terrible bad thing that needs to go away. I can't even decide this because on one hand, I have kind of this normative idea of what I would like to happen, what I would like to see in the world and what I'd like to see in the diplomatic stage. And then there's the realist side of me that says, well, countries have to act within their own interest, even if it is to provoke the enemy out so that, you know, something can be done about it. It's a really tough place to be because what it does is that it means that you overlook anything ethical and you only look at national self-interest. In terms of the Jerusalem move, the moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, you know, the idealistic side or the normative side of me would say, well, that's just a ridiculous move. Like, why would you ever do that? It endangers so many people. It risks a flare-up. You literally put lives at risk. And at the same time, the realist side of me says, well, Jerusalem has been the capital of Israel for the past at least 50 years, if not longer. And they are the United States' biggest ally. Why not throw them a bone? So there's two sides of this that I think isn't appreciated necessarily. Is that realistic side?
Would you say that Israel's recent actions in Syria are along the same lines? Realist international politics?
Well, actually, I would say that Israel's actions in Syria are almost normative. Like, you have Israel's greatest enemy in Syria operating militias, effectively, close to the Iranian border. ISIS also has a cell on the border of the Golan Heights that Israel currently occupies. So I don't have much of an issue of Israel having an active participation in the war in Syria for its own interest. Again, I think actually the part of Nikki Haley's comment that I would agree with is, who among us would accept the type of activity on the border? No one would. No country would put up with what is going on in Syria. Now, would any other country around the table put up with what's going on in Gaza? It depends on what was actually happening in Gaza, and it's very difficult to tell because of these conflicting reports. I noticed, John, that you said that some of the reports were disputed, but disputed by who? Like, were they disputed by Arab media, by Palestinian media, by particularly left-leaning media in the States or in the UK or in other parts of Europe? So these questions, especially when it comes to such a divisive issue, I'm just so suspicious about claims and about counterclaims. The one thing I will say, though, just to make sure that this is well understood, is death is evil in every sense. And so it's a shocking thing that has happened, and the fact that Israel has done this is in itself horrific and abhorrent. But I still think the situation isn't well understood, and I want to know more about it.
Same, actually. When researching for this story, I found that the official narrative from each side has been disputed by each side.
Right, of course.
So it's almost impossible to really understand what's going on in the middle. You do see the outcome of it, however, and you see 58 people dead and almost 2,000 wounded, and you kind of step back and say, was that level of force really necessary?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's where my question comes in. This is not the place to debate the legitimacy of the Israeli state, but when we are talking about realist international politics, what bothers me about that so much is that so often you see realist national politics masqueraded as idealistic international politics, by which I mean the United States probably views, in a realist sense, Assad, for instance, as somebody that they don't want to be in power, and they view in their national interest, toppling Assad would be in their national interest. However, the arguments that they use for advocating overthrowing that regime are idealistic ones to appeal to the masses, like, well, he bombed his own people and he gassed his own people. These are for humanitarian reasons.
He shouldn't be there. Yeah.
Right, exactly. I would be much happier if they were just honest and said, well, no, it's not in our national interest for Assad to be in power, so we're going to topple him, even though he might bring stability to the region. It doesn't work for our national interest. So that's what annoys me, because it just leads to this dishonesty. And also, I think it leads to moral relativism, because you can look at the actions that Israel took and say, yeah, people died, but ultimately, it's in their national interest. And that's what matters on the international stage. And at the same time, on the opposite side, there's no single realist policy. If you're on the left and you don't support intervention in Syria, the realist politics there is essentially, well, yeah, Assad's a bad guy and he does all these terrible things to his own people. But realistically, if we topple him, it's going to create much bigger issues. So we can tolerate these atrocities.
That's right. That's right. That is realism, yeah.
Right, exactly. And I fall into that camp.
Mm.
My politics, or my international politics, from a realist point of view, are, yeah, he's a bad guy. Yeah, maybe he gassed his own people. But what's the alternative?
Mm.
If we topple his regime, you potentially have what filling the void?
Right.
Al-Qaeda, ISIS.
Russia.
Who knows what?
Yeah.
Russia, right? I would say, hey, from a realist perspective, no, we shouldn't. But from the opposite side of the political spectrum, the realist side would say, no, it's not in our national interest for Assad to be in power because he's a tool of the Russians. And no matter what comes from that, we'll deal with the consequences because we don't want a pro-Russia regime in power. So we're okay with toppling that regime.
Well, to understand Gaza a little bit better, it is the hotbed for Hamas, which is an anti-Israel terrorist organization that literally fires rockets into Israel. So, for instance, if you know you've got a bunch of potential migrants walking up to the American border from the south, you're not going to shoot at them. You shouldn't shoot at them, because the expectation is there that they are simply migrants and they're coming up to the border. Yes, they're going to enter the country illegally, but they're not a threat. When you have a situation of, and remember the situation that happened this week in Gaza is actually the culmination of 6 weeks of protest, there's a sense that when these types of flare-ups happen, there is a very real possibility that an organization like Hamas is behind it. Therefore, there is a lack of trust on the part of the IDF, the Israeli forces, that will say we need to treat these folk as if they are hostile to us, which is possible and arguable if you want to get into the whole Gaza-Israel thing anyway. Keeping an entire nation penned into a little cage is not the best way to fix national problems. So, of course, you're going to have anti-Israeli sentiment in Gaza. When two sides meet like that, when you have an instance of one flare-up with one side against the other, there are just different calculations being taken into account. They're not long-term calculations. They're very short-term. It's like, how likely am I going to survive this day? Or how likely is it that something happens to us, or that a bomb is thrown over here, or, so there are different calculations that I respect. I get it, in a sense.
It's acting out of self-defense.
Effectively, yeah. And so that's the part of Haley's comments that I agree with, because no other country would put up with hostiles on the border.
I think you're right that the actions being taken are on a short-term calculus. And I think that's part of the problem. These types of events make it less and less likely that you're ever going to reach a peace deal.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
Even the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem instead of Tel Aviv would be seen by the Palestinians as an aggressive act.
Yeah, of course, of course. But Trump and Netanyahu are buddy-buddy anyway.
That's true. I mean, we saw Netanyahu's influence on axing the Iran deal.
There you go.
I think that Israel has a very strong influence on the United States and what we do internationally as well. So I think that I don't want to say that a two-state solution is dead, but it's getting close to that, don't you think?
I don't want to call it dead now. I don't want to start the autopsy yet, because remember, both the Netanyahu government and the Trump administration are just administrations. They will be gone eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about Israel and when we talk about the US, perhaps maybe we should be talking about the Trump administration and the Netanyahu administration, because as soon as you have the likes of the Zionist Union, the Labour Party essentially in Israel, which has a two-state solution as part of its party platform, come to power, you know, perhaps it's back on the table. Say you have an Obama-type administration, perhaps even a Bernie-type administration in the US talking with a Labour Party administration in Israel, perhaps you have a completely different outcome. So I wouldn't call it dead in the water yet, but I would say that as long as these two administrations exist, especially as they exist simultaneously, there's no hope.
I mean, I know that it's only an administration, but researching for this story, I found that the Likud party is only growing in support, even as recently as late April this year. Polls are suggesting that they would gain even more seats in the Knesset than they have today. And so I'm wondering if the public perception of the more conservative, more Zionist policies is taking more of a foothold in Israel, which will affect this situation far past Netanyahu's government. Are his Zionist policies moving the Overton window in Israel more towards an exclusivist policy where they're not looking for a two-state solution? I think we have to pay attention to those trends over time. And things like this, even after acts like this, Netanyahu is still popular because he's seen as defending the sovereignty of Israel, and people might not necessarily have too much of a problem with it because Gazans and Hamas in particular are so demonized. Yes, we can look at this through a realist lens and we can understand that they were acting in their national interest and their self-defense, but at the same time, for the long-term health of the region, I think events like this only make things worse.
We're going to stay in the Middle East for this next bit. And John, I want to know how much you know about Iraqi politics, because your country did invade the place, so.
Unfortunately, Adam, I know very little. I do know that there was an important election last week.
That's right. It happened on Saturday, on May 12th. These are the 2018 Iraqi elections, and they were particularly important because they were the first ones to happen after the downfall. Can we call it the downfall yet? After the main threat of ISIS? Let's say that.
I think that would be fair to say, seeing as how ISIS is losing its control in Syria and being pushed back every day. Their goals for a new caliphate seem to basically have been stopped completely. So,
and they've almost entirely been kicked out of Iraq. We've needed a whole week to figure out who won because it just takes a while to tally results in Iraq. But the results were interesting. They turned out to be quite bad for the US, but also quite bad for Iran, who was the other major international player in the Iraqi elections, as much as there should be international players in domestic elections. But that's kind of the point, and we'll get to them. These elections took place in a time in which corruption has been running rampant in Iraq, in which Iran has been pushing itself into domestic politics, let's say. And of course, you have the Trump factor, you know, Trump himself being rather unpopular in Iraq at the moment. So all of this together actually produced an outcome of about 44% turning out to vote. That's 15% lower than 2014. But like I said, it was an interesting night nonetheless. Now, it would be pointless for me to try and map out what the political party scene would look like in Iraq, because there's so many different types of cleavages within the society that there's just hundreds of parties. So you have ideological parties, so you've got communists, you have socialists, you have liberals, but then you also have religious parties, so you have secularists and Shias and Sunnis. And then, of course, you've got nationalist parties and Kurdish parties and Iraqi statewide parties. There's just a massive number of parties it's not worth going into. So what the party scene tends to do in Iraq is to form itself into sets of coalitions. And each coalition elects a leader to lead it into the election. So there are three coalitions, maybe four, actually, that I'd like to share with you, John. The first is the Victory Alliance, led by Haider al-Abadi. Now, al-Abadi is the current Prime Minister of Iraq. He is a fervent US ally, but he's also an ally of Iran. It was a bad night for him because his coalition finished third, with only 46 seats in a 329-seat parliament.
Wow.
But it was an even worse night for former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. I wonder if you remember him. He was one of the first prime ministers to take over Iraq after the American administration allowed for domestic elections again.
Vaguely, yes.
Yeah, his coalition, the State of Law Coalition, lost 66 seats and now they only have 26. So he's essentially done in Iraqi politics. But the real pair of coalitions that I'd like to focus on are the Fatah Alliance and the Alliance of Revolutionaries for Reform. Now, this was a very interesting one because Fatah, led by Hadi al-Amiri, was the pro-Iranian faction. They were essentially Iran's spokespeople in Iraq. They only finished second, even though they were polling high. There was a large expectation that they would finish first. In fact, the majority of the Iraqi population is Shia. The majority of Iran is Shia. The government of Iran is a Shia government. So they were very pro-Shia populations. But the winner, Muqtada al-Sadr, came in with 56 seats. So he is the largest party, or he has the largest party in the Iraqi Council of Representatives. Now, this is a little funny. It's not so much an issue, it's just a nice correlation, let's say. The party is known as Sairon, or Sairun, in Arabic, which means on the move, which if you were to translate into French would be En Marche, which was the name of Macron's party as he was heading into the presidential election.
That's right.
But in the same way as Macron, al-Sadr has actually used the same strategy of building a coalition amongst centrists, among reformers, among people that want to bring about a new Iraq, and has pursued a nationalist line. Because Macron was fairly nationalist, I would say. All French people are nationalists. Al-Sadr was able to bring together a party of secularists, a party of communists, as well as a certain number of Shia theocrats into the same party. Now, how was he able to do that?
Those factions make for strange bedfellows.
Exactly. Where the US-backed alliance failed was because it was supported by the US. Where the Iran faction failed was because it was supported by Iran. What al-Sadr did is he took elements of the society that simply wanted Iraq for the Iraqis. Not for Iran, not for the US, Iraq for the Iraqis. It was a movement that's aimed at kicking out foreign intervention in domestic affairs. And on that, it became the largest party in the Council of Representatives.
It's funny, I can't help but draw parallels between Iraq for the Iraqis and make Iraq great again.
Well, I think the main difference is that you literally have two major foreign entities interfering within your domestic affairs. Whereas in the States, for instance, you are just a domestic mess. So
sad but true.
So Iraq for the Iraqis really does have salient meaning. For the regular Iraqi who's dealing with corruption, who's still dealing with US forces on the ground, who's still dealing with an Iran that, you know, is literally building in both sectarian and potentially racist divisions into the country. Again, being Shia, potentially having an effect on the country's Shia majority. Iraq for the Iraqis really does begin to ring a little bit louder than Make America Great Again.
I can imagine that's true. I'm sure there's a lot of fatigue in the Iraqi citizenry after 15 years of essentially occupation by the United States.
And a growing Iranian force after a lot of their sanctions were lifted and now they have money. What? Muqtada al-Sadr is an interesting character in himself, and he has quite impressive, I guess you could say, anti-US credentials. He himself led two uprisings against US forces back in the early days of the occupation. More recently, his supporters have stormed the Iraqi parliament, as they did in 2016, and they breached the Green Zone. Peacefully, mostly. The Green Zone is the area in Baghdad that hosts all the government offices. It's essentially a government precinct. It also hosts most of the international embassies, as well as multiple NGOs that are working in the country. So it's protected, I believe, by the US and Iraqi forces. It's heavily fortified so that not much can get into it. But nonetheless, he was able to get into it himself, and he led a peaceful demonstration saying that this Green Zone itself shouldn't be here. The Green Zone is a monument to the corruption that exists within the state. That type of rhetoric flies very well in an Iraq that is not doing so well with the, again, particularly the corruption, but also the interfering of foreign powers. While Sadr has won, his nationalist credentials haven't really been tested yet, and he wasn't a candidate himself, so he is leading a party that he's not actually going to have a political seat. He is going to have a lot of influence, though. He ran on a platform of diversifying the economy, curbing corruption, increasing the efficiency of services, but it's only a party of 54 seats in a 329-seat parliament. So he's going to have to build a coalition. You know, there were over 7,000 candidates that ran for these 329 seats, and they're going to be a mass of people that are going to be in occupying those 329 seats. His political savvy is unknown. We don't even know if he is a good coalition builder. Therefore, we don't even know if he's going to be in power himself or have his party be in power. So he is a little bit of an unknown quality. There was a great quote that I came across that paints a really nice picture of the possibilities that could happen, because remember, he ran on a non-sectarian platform. There's another thing. He wants Sunni re-enfranchisement. So the Sunnis, being the minority Muslim group, have been disenfranchised by the new system. He wants to bring them back in, even as a Shia cleric himself. But nonetheless, here is the problem in front of al-Sadr now. This is from a senior Iraqi diplomat. If the bridge between Iraqi Arab Shia and Iran is greater than the bridge between Iraqi Arab Shia and Sunnis, then that could mark the end. There might be the temptation to take the easy route in a coalition and side with Shia-only groups. Fatah, for instance, the Iranian-backed group. But at that, you would eliminate, you know, his own party platform of non-sectarianism. So it's actually ended up being a really interesting case. It's an interesting next step in the history of Iraq. We'll need to see where it goes.
That's definitely something that needs to be monitored. I was fairly young when the United States invaded Iraq and we toppled their government there, and it was pretty chaotic for a long time. And I remember that one of the biggest political issues that blocked a coherent government from taking control was this divide between Shia and Sunni Muslims inside of Iraq.
And there was a great saying at the time as well that Bush had no idea what a Sunni or Shia was before invading Iraq.
Yes. I don't think a lot of people in the American government knew that. We seem to have stepped into this without understanding the 1,000 years of history behind these two groups. And I think there was a naive belief that if we just introduced democracy to this area, that somehow all those issues would go away. But you can't end sectarian issues that are rooted in the deepest history of Islam itself.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
Because the democratic government is ultimately going to pit those two groups against the interests of the other. So when I saw the results of this election, and particular that such an outspoken critic and even revolutionary against the United States had such broad support, mm-hmm. I couldn't help but just think how much of a failure this experiment has been on the part of the United States. Mm. So we had a Ba'athist Sunni government in place under Saddam. Obviously, he was a dictator, but he was predominantly a secularist. He was almost sort of along the lines of something like a democratic socialist. Not to justify Saddam at all, he was an evil dictator and he was a horror to his own people. But we destabilized the entire region. We saw the birth of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which morphed into ISIS. And ultimately, at the end of the day, after hundreds of thousands of lives had been lost, thousands of lives in the United States side have been lost, billions of dollars of infrastructure investment have gone into this. And what we have is factions that were created because of our invasion destabilizing Syria. We have a strong link between the Shias in Iran and the Shias in Iraq, Iran being one of our top enemies in the world. And now we have popular support for an anti-US character that could potentially it's not guaranteed, but he could potentially gain power within the government. So we went from having an anti-US government that was stable to potentially having an anti-US government that's not very stable. It's almost like we've just flushed billions of dollars and 15 years of war down the drain.
But that is ideally the end goal of the occupation, is that you invade, you occupy, you allow a democratic system to build up. Eventually, you're going to have an Iraqi system that is going to vote for Iraqi people, even if it's counter to, you know, your own invasion, in a sense. Because no one is going to like the occupation of their country.
That's true. But then if you also go back to our discussion earlier about realism in international politics, it's not in the United States' interests for an anti-US government to be in power in Iraq.
But it is also fortunate that he's anti-Iran, and he's building good relations with Saudi Arabia. So perhaps there's kind of a back doorway into good graces.
Well, potentially, but also at the same time, as we were discussing, in order for him to build a coalition, he may have to sacrifice some of his platform to gain Shia support, which would mean moving more towards favoritism towards Iran.
That's right.
In order for him to even get into power, it's likely that he would have to make concessions to the Shia majority that are sympathetic towards Iran. So I definitely think this is something that we need to monitor closely, because it could develop into something where we're even in a worse position than we were prior to our invasion. Because whatever you want to say about Saddam, toppling Saddam was actually good for Iran.
Yeah.
Saddam was against Iran. I mean, he invaded them in the 80s, and they had an almost nine-year war. Prior to our invasion, one of the largest checks on Iranian power and activity in the Middle East was Saddam. And you potentially could have a government in Iraq that will be not necessarily pro-Iran, but much less against Iran than Saddam was. So it's definitely something that needs to be monitored and hopefully not turn into another overthrow of a democratically elected regime.
One of the most fascinating things I find about this in particular is that al-Sadr himself is a populist nationalist. So even in Iraq, the patterns that we're seeing happening in Europe, happening in North America, happening in Israel, even happening in India, are also happening in Iraq. People are beginning to get a sense of the national identity, the nationalism again, the populism again. It's a very interesting phenomenon to be watching. In some cases, it's not all bad. I think in the case of Iraq, this could actually be a positive step forward. For them to take a step towards populism, towards nationalism, I think would be good in terms of building up an Iraq for the Iraqis again. And what we could see is potentially the strongest Iraqi government that the country's had since the fall of Saddam Hussein, which is arguably a good thing, but it'll come at the cost of American interest in the region. Recently, there have been challenges to the DACA program in the United States as the Trump administration has asked the judicial system to take a look at the program. At the same time, the Trump administration itself has been taken to court for its approach to the DACA program. John takes a look at its history, its context, and its current status.
Immigration and assimilation have always been at the heart of American identity. Since its inception, the United States has been a nation of immigrants, fashioning itself as the proverbial melting pot. Unlike other nations, whose national identities are derived from an ethnically homogeneous citizenry like Scotland, Sweden, France, Spain, England, and many others, the United States has been built upon the shared values of the American Constitution. Regardless of nationality and origin, accepting the values of America makes you uniquely American, and civic nationalism is the root of the American identity. Because of this, the United States has attracted immigration from every country on Earth with the promise of creating a new life of opportunity. In recent decades, concern has grown over the sustainability of immigration into America, driven mostly by the debate over how to address illegal immigration. Lax enforcement of existing immigration laws and widespread use of undocumented labor has led to a unique problem. Many undocumented families have been able to stay in the United States for long enough to build lives and families. While there has been support for deporting those who came to the United States illegally, the line has not been so clear when it comes to their children. Congress has wrestled with what to do with these children that were brought here illegally through no fault of their own since the early 2000s with the introduction of the DREAM Act. An acronym for the Development, Relief, and Education for Alien Minors Act, the DREAM Act was first introduced in the Senate on August 1, 2001, to bridge the gap between the two sides of the debate. The bill was brought to the floor by Democrat Dick Durbin and Republican Orrin Hatch, with the aim of neither allowing indiscriminate deportation of undocumented immigrants or blanket amnesty. The bill focused on the children of undocumented immigrants with no legal status, who were brought to the United States as children, and laid out a series of requirements which would allow for a path to permanent residency. The requirements were fairly simple. In order to be eligible for the program, applicants must have been younger than 18 when they were first brought to the United States. They must have proof of 4 consecutive years of residence in the United States since their date of arrival. They must have been between the ages of 12 and 35 when the bill was enacted. They must have graduated from an American high school, obtained a GED, or been admitted to a higher education institution. If they were male, they were required to register with the Selective Service, and finally, they must be of good moral character. If an applicant met these requirements, they would be granted conditional status for a 6-year period, during which they would be required to have either graduated from a 2-year degree program, completed at least 2 years towards a 4-year degree, or have served 2 years in the United States military. During this time, the applicants were not eligible to apply for federal student aid grants, such as Pell Grants. If all these conditions were met and the applicants were able to pass an additional series of background and criminal checks, they will be eligible for permanent residency. Should the applicant fail to meet all these requirements, their conditional status would have been revoked and they would be subject to deportation. Although the DREAM Act did have some bipartisan support, the increasing polarization of Congress became a significant hurdle, with hardliners on both sides of the issue believing the act did not go far enough. Various versions of the act were proposed through the early and mid-2000s, and some versions did pass through the House and some through the Senate, but both houses of Congress could not agree on a version to pass. After the election of Barack Obama, partisan splits in Congress led to gridlock that made it all but impossible for the DREAM Act to pass. Facing obstruction in Congress, which scuttled any attempts to pass the DREAM Act, and a growing concern over immigration, on June 15, 2012, President Obama announced a new policy, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. This was established by a memorandum by the Secretary of Homeland Security, and the program began accepting applicants in August 2012. The program largely followed the eligibility guidelines laid out in the DREAM Act. To qualify, applicants must have come to the United States before their 16th birthday. They must have lived continuously in the United States since June 15, 2007. They needed to be under the age of 31 on June 15, 2012, and physically present in the United States on June 15, 2012, and at the time of making the request for consideration. They could not have any legal status as of June 15, 2012, and would need to have completed high school or a GED, or have been honorably discharged from the armed forces. Applicants could not have been convicted of a felony or serious misdemeanors, or three or more other misdemeanors. Qualifying applicants were also not allowed to travel abroad except for educational, employment, and humanitarian purposes. If applicants met all of these requirements, they could apply for a two-year deferral on deportation and become eligible for a work permit. Deferred status was also renewable upon review, provided the applicant demonstrated good behavior and did not violate any laws or conditions of the program. The program did not provide a path to citizenship and only applied to children brought to the United States illegally. Initial estimates by the Pew Research Center found that nearly 1.7 million individuals may be eligible for the program. However, as of June 2016, there have only been about 845,000 initial applications, of which just over 740,000 were approved. In that same period, 606,000 renewal applications had been received, with 526,000 being approved. In November 2014, President Obama announced an expansion of the program, which would include any undocumented immigrants who entered the United States before 2010. This would also remove the requirement that applicants be under the age of 31, and it would lengthen the renewal period from 2 years. Pew Research estimated that this would expand the number of eligible individuals by about 330,000. However, these changes did not ultimately take effect. Texas and 25 other states challenged the expansion in court, and in February of 2014, Judge Andrew S. Hannon of the District Court of the Southern District of Texas put a preliminary injunction on the expansion while the case progressed. The case ultimately made its way to the Supreme Court, where, following the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, the Supreme Court split 4-4, leaving the injunction in place, though not repealing the initial program that was established in 2012. Opposition to the program was immediate. Republicans and some Democrats, even, were against DACA from the beginning. Many saw it as an undemocratic overreach by the president, bypassing the legitimacy of congressional action to make substantive changes to immigration policy. Regardless, only the expansion was halted by injunction, and no court has yet ruled the original framework of DACA unconstitutional. The effects of DACA have generally been positive for eligible participants. Research has suggested that DACA recipients are no more likely to commit crimes than natural-born citizens, and in 2016, the Journal of Public Economics found that post-DACA job market participation has increased, and levels of poverty have fallen among illegal immigrant families at the lower end of income distribution. One survey found that 91% of recipients are employed and 5% have started their own businesses, compared to just over 3% of the general population. Proponents of DACA claim that repealing the program would be a net loss for the U.S. economy, with some estimates predicting a reduction of U.S. GDP of nearly $433 billion over the next 10 years. When costs of deportation are taken into account, the net positive effect of DACA recipients on the U.S. economy could be as high as $250,000 per recipient. Results are mixed when it comes to education, however, where it seems there is not a significant effect on the probability of DACA recipients graduating from school. However, studies do suggest that the DACA program has had a positive effect on the mental health of eligible children of illegal immigrant mothers, and no significant increase has been observed in immigration flow. Those who do not support DACA argue that although the program may have led to a positive effect on its recipients, it does not mean that the law should be subverted. Critics also claim that the focus on children is emotional manipulation. Although they were children when they were brought here, this should not allow them to break the law. They should go through the normal channel of applying for citizenship. After the election of Donald Trump, on September 5, 2017, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that DACA would be repealed and that it was up to Congress to act. Without a DACA alternative being passed by Congress, the program would expire in 6 months, and DACA recipients would become subject to deportation. Current recipients could potentially be granted a 2-year renewal if their applications were received by October 5th of 2017, but barring that, the Trump administration recommended that DACA recipients use these 6 months to make arrangements to leave the country. On April 24th, 2018, Judge John D. Bates of the District Court of the District of Columbia ruled that the Trump administration must continue accepting new applicants for DACA, but he delayed his decision by 90 days to allow the Department of Homeland Security to explain why the program is being canceled. So far, an alternative to DACA has not been successful in Congress, with clear battle lines drawn between Republicans and Democrats. This will likely become a central campaign issue for the 2018 midterms, with Democrats believing the majority of Americans support DACA and would like to see it remain in place. It remains to be seen, however, if this will ultimately have a legislative solution. With multiple challenges to DACA itself and also to the repeal of DACA making their way through the federal court system, we may only get a resolution via the Supreme Court. Remember, the only other DACA case considered by the Supreme Court did not set a precedent and was divided among conservative and liberal lines. With the new arrival of Trump's Supreme Court pick, Neil Gorsuch, it is likely that the court would fall on the side of the Trump administration. Regardless of the outcome, this uncertainty has left recipients in the program in limbo, not knowing whether they should prepare to stay in the United States or to leave. The debate is far from over, but extreme partisanship in the American political system likely means that this issue will not be decided by Congress, for better or worse. Finally today, we take a look at the news stories you should be paying attention to in this next week.
So I'm going to start in Scotland. I'm going to start at home. On Wednesday this week, the Scottish Parliament voted overwhelmingly against consenting to the Brexit withdrawal bill that's currently making its way through the Westminster Parliament. Now, via the Sewell Convention, any bill that's passed by Westminster which modifies the competencies afforded to the devolved administration in Scotland must receive legislative consent from the Scottish Parliament. Of course, this is only a convention, and ultimately, the UK operates on the principle of parliamentary sovereignty. So the Westminster Parliament is within its legal rights to ignore the Scottish Parliament altogether. However, this could cause a political crisis. You can't cause a constitutional crisis in a country that doesn't have a constitution, but it can cause a political crisis, as the votes of not only the SNP, but the Greens, the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats will all be ignored if the Brexit bill goes ahead. Scotland needs to know its place, apparently. The bill repatriates all powers currently wielded by the EU to the UK. The Scottish Government and the supporting parties argue that some of those powers must be repatriated directly to Scotland, given the laws governing devolution. The vote was split 93-30, with only the Conservatives giving their consent to a Conservative Party bill. Ignoring a legislative consent motion like the one that the Parliament of Scotland has just passed could lead to nothing, especially given that politically Westminster again is within their right to do so. But developments, especially regarding Ireland and other parts of the Brexit process, have become very political and very divisive. This could be another thing that complicates the Brexit process that could even bring down the British government, and that is something to watch for.
Switching gears to Korea. This is both an update to our coverage of the North Korean-South Korean summit that happened a couple weeks ago and also a look ahead. Unsurprisingly, North Korea has threatened to pull themselves out of talks with South Korea and also from the summit that was planned with President Trump regarding the denuclearization of North Korea. Kim Jong-un cited the words of John Bolton, unsurprisingly, saying that it's naive to think that North Korea will be forced to give up its nuclear weapons as John Bolton suggested. Now, North Korea has a history with John Bolton. Once they described him as human scum for his interventionist policies when it comes to North Korea. So that's interesting. You have potentially the greatest diplomatic achievement of the Trump administration being threatened by the presence of their national security advisor. Another part of the story is that South Korea and the United States have been participating in military drills, which drew the ire of North Korea. It'll be interesting to see whether or not this newfound peace process that's ongoing between North Korea and South Korea continues, or if Kim's going to pull out of that entirely. So we'll have to keep a watch on that.
So I can already tell you now what I'll be talking about next week. On Friday next week, the 25th of May, Ireland will go to the polls in a constitutional referendum. The means by which the Irish constitution is amended is exclusively via popular referendum. And next week, Ireland will decide whether a constitutional ban on abortion should remain in place. The 8th Amendment of the Irish constitution, which has been in place since 1983, guarantees the right to life of a fetus. Ireland can be characterised by waning social conservatism. It was the first country to legalise equal marriage via referendum in 2015. So will its next progressive step be in the form of legalising abortion in the same way? No matter which side of the fence that you fall on, this is really worth paying attention to this last week of the campaign. Support for legalisation is ahead in the polls, but the gap has been closing over the past month. It'll be something to watch.
My second and last story today comes from the United States. Listeners of this podcast will likely remember last year, the FCC overturned the net neutrality rules that were put in place by the Obama administration. This caused quite a controversy at the time, as proponents of net neutrality said that this could essentially legalize throttling by internet service providers on content that they either disagree with or even of competitors. This could potentially severely limit free speech expression on the internet. Now, the only way to stop these rules from being repealed is for Congress to act and pass a bill enforcing net neutrality across the board. The Senate this week passed a bill reinforcing the net neutrality rules that were put in place by the Obama administration. This required three Republicans to switch, which is very interesting. However, you might not want to get your hopes up, because the next hurdle for this bill is to go through the House of Representatives, which is much more heavily weighted in the favor of Republicans. It's unlikely that there will be enough switched votes for this to pass through the House, and even if it did, it would be expected that President Trump would veto it. However, supporters of net neutrality in the states may want to call their representatives in this next week to see if they could potentially switch their votes. And even though it's not likely that Trump would sign it into law, it's still worth the effort. This is likely to become a big campaign issue going into the 2018 midterms. And if there is enough coverage on this that the House of Representatives is not going to pass a bill which is largely popular in the United States, this could affect the midterm elections, and maybe we would see an increase in Democratic seats in the House.
If you're listening to this on Friday and you're particularly partial towards a monarchy or two, then you know that there's a royal wedding on tomorrow, on Saturday. Hooray! In an unrelated note, police have been confiscating sleeping bags from homeless people in the town of Windsor, where there happens to be a royal wedding this weekend.
And that's all we have time for this week. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Absurdistanis. We're also on YouTube as Absurdistan with an exclamation point. Be sure to check out our website, absurdistanis.com. That's absurdistanis.com. We post all episodes to this website and also host forums for discussion so that you as the audience can engage with our content. Thank you for listening, and as always, stay informed.